Goals.
That's what we like to do on this show. Find the comedy goals.
I just like non-fungible as a word.
It is a good word.
It's a wonderful, it just has a good mouth feel.
La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the 11 o'clock hour of As Goes Wisconsin on this Juneteenth. Very excited to have you here. Excited to have Jane Madden here, as always. And excited about our next topic because I feel like it's something that is looming, but we don't necessarily know what it's going to look like, but a lot of hopes are hung on it. And so, as we know, back in April, the state voted pretty handily to elect Justice-elect Janet Protasiewicz. And with that comes pending lawsuits that will probably go to the Supreme Court once she gets inaugurated in August, which includes redistricting. And something we talk about a lot on this show is if only we could get rid of gerrymandering, what would that look like? And sometimes I think there's wish casting as far as, oh, everything would change, because you look at what the statewide elections typically are, 14 out of 17 going to Democrats, but it may not be the case. And so I wanted to have a little bit more realistic conversation about what it could look like. And so our guest for this half hour is John Johnson, who is a research fellow at Marquette University Law School, who's written and studied our maps a lot. And so you have opinions, you have thoughts, right, John?
I do. That is true. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
And so what, as far as you understand, is the kind of potential, the timeline for potentially new maps?
Right. So the new balance of power on the Supreme Court will take effect in August. The filing deadline for candidates for the November 2024 election is June 1st. Of course, new maps would need to be in place well before that.
Yeah.
So prospective candidates would know what district they were in, would be able to collect signatures from the proper voters, all of which means that this, if we get new maps, it would need to happen pretty soon this fall or at winter at the latest to allow for that to happen. Now, I think it
is that possible?
So we learned a lot about doing this on a compressed schedule during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because that pushed the census data release way, way back from when it was anticipated. And of course, redistricting takes place after the new census data comes out. So that happened on a really compressed schedule. And it was pretty painful, especially for the poor people who have to actually draw the ward boundaries, this like technical task that happens after the political districts have been made. Those people really suffered. But you know what? Their preferences don't get taken into account. So we learned through that process that it can be done. It's not pleasant, but it's possible. And I think something similar, you know, would happen here if this case is actually heard and decided in a way that creates new maps.
So let's say that the case is heard, the case is decided. But what our state constitution says right now is that the legislature draws the maps, right?
Yeah.
And so who would draw the maps this time around?
Just the courts, I think.
Courts. Sure. Okay. So wouldn't be some new independent, like when they would talk about fair maps and what Iowa does and having like an independent body. That would have to be a different thing in the future. This would just be courts drawing the maps.
Yeah, an independent body would have to be created by law, you know, by the legislature and the governor. And as it stands, just over the course of Wisconsin history, very frequently the courts have drawn the maps. It was a little bit unusual that in 2010 we had unified government, mm-hmm. under Republicans, which led to them drawing the maps. But in other years, it was very commonly a federal court actually drawing the maps. I think the last time a state court drew the maps was like in the 60s, though I'm not positive about that, though it has happened before. Usually it's federal courts because federal courts have a little bit more expertise in how to do this because they do it frequently around the country.
And so likely in that scenario, then, would it be maps that were already submitted the last time this came in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
That's that's an option they would have. Sure. Yeah. I mean, they had many people have submitted proposals to this point. In case your listeners are curious about what a redistricting plan actually like is, in most instances, it's a really long spreadsheet, like an Excel file, that has every census block in one column and then a district assignment in the other column. And census blocks are really, really tiny areas. It's the smallest level at which the census publishes data. And, you know, you've got to arrange them all so that they're compact and contiguous and have an equal amount of the population. So, you know, 1/99th of the state's population in the case of the assembly. So that's what a plan actually is.
Okay.
And they've got a stack of those sitting there. They would still be using the original census estimates from 2020. It's not like they would be trying to rebalance the population now. They could draw their own. They could appoint a special master to do it. There's many options that they would have.
We're talking to John Johnson, who is a research fellow at Marquette University Law School, about future potential scenarios of new maps. There's still a lot of ifs. There's very little guarantees yet, even though a lot of people are very excited about the chance that we could get new maps before 2031. But when we say neutral maps compared to politically drawn maps, because as much as we know for sure, Wisconsin currently is one of the most gerrymandered places in the country, just the south of us in the Democrats' favor, Illinois, very gerrymandered. So like when we actually talk about neutral maps, what is the criteria that is considered and not considered in comparison to what we have now?
Right. No, it's a great question. So Wisconsin law does actually say like what the districts are supposed to do. They have to be contiguous, which means all the pieces have to touch each other. And then there's some weird rules about like what that means when you have water, because you know many towns have lakes. So
even we do have a lot of rules, we have a lot of water
there's
here.
There's a lot of other stuff in there about what exactly that means. But they got to be contiguous, and that's basically clear. It says that they need to be compact, and there are mathematical ways you can measure compactness, like you can divide the land area by the perimeter or something like that. But it doesn't say what it means; it just says compact. In the law. And then there's also instructions that you should avoid crossing municipal boundaries where you can, which flies in the face of compactness in some cases. And then also you really should avoid crossing county borders when possible. And then of course, all of those principles are superseded by needing to have equal populations in each district.
Okay.
So you have a set of principles that are sometimes competing with each other, but that you can take all into account. You kind of got to order them in order of importance. One way you can think about drawing neutral districts is having just like a group of people who aren't affiliated with either party or seen as not being interested in partisan advantage, just sort of sit down and draw them without even referring to any information about the political party's performance in those areas, which is what most states do who have a nonpartisan system. Researchers will try to simulate the nonpartisan geography of a state by creating these algorithms that'll generate tons and tons and tons and tons of maps following the stated criteria that you have. And then they'll calculate the partisan lean of each one of those and then talk about the distribution of partisan benefits that come from neutrally drawn maps. The Supreme Court really hates doing that. The John Roberts has said a lot of, he's really not into the complicated statistical stuff, just sort of across the board in their rulings. But some of the lower federal courts have been quite taken with that method of demonstrating partisan bias in maps. So, you know, that's sort of one way you can get a sense of the range of possibilities in a state. In Wisconsin, you know, I think a useful way to think about the range of outcomes that you can see across Wisconsin's geography is to look at the maps that were ultimately submitted to the Supreme Court last year. So you have the old map, you can calculate the results mm-hmm. of that. You have the new map, which was sort of the refresh of the gerrymander that Republican legislators drew. Then you have the People's Map Commission final submission, which was this group that Republicans would say was a Democratic group, but which the Evers administration created in what they claimed was a nonpartisan mm-hmm. fashion. And that district or that group drew a set of districts without any regard for the previous map. They were like, we're just going to use these principles and we're going to draw these 99 seats without even thinking about what the old map looked like. Then the Supreme Court had this initial ruling where they said, we're only going to look for a least change version from the previous maps. And so the Evers administration submitted their own version of a least change map, which was more beneficial to Democrats than the one that was ultimately chosen.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you can look at the range of outcomes across all of those to get a sense of what it might mean. So I took the last assembly election and looked at how those votes would have tallied up for either party under each of these maps.
Mm-hmm.
Your listeners may be wondering, well, how did you do that? Because in a lot of cases, there wasn't an incumbent running. What I actually did is I used the four statewide races to model the assembly vote in each place.
Okay.
Because people don't split their tickets very much anymore. They do a little bit, but you can pretty well predict what the outcome in any seat is going to be if you know those four statewide races.
That's interesting. We did get Ron Johnson and Evers in the same election, so there was some split ticket voting.
Both incumbents.
So that's true.
Incumbency helps a lot, and we can talk about that some more later too if you're interested. Okay, so in the actual results, Democrats won 35 seats. There's 99. You need 50 for a majority. Under the old map, they probably would have won 36 seats.
So okay.
That gives you a sense of how the new gerrymander just kind of updated a little bit the old one. Under the Evers least change plan, the plan his administration submitted, probably 39.
Okay.
For Democrats. And under the People's Map Commission plan, 43 seats for Democrats, probably.
All right.
Under that sort of more neutrally drawn
system. So that's a good setup for us going into break and to come back as far as what the geography actually tells us beyond political partisan gerrymandering. There is a political divide in our state. So we're going to talk more about that, of the reality of even with new maps, what that could actually look like, with John Johnson, a research fellow from Marquette University Law School. When we come back, this is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry, along with Jane Matt-Nair, and we are talking to John Johnson, who is a research fellow at Marquette University Law School, about geography and gerrymandering and what potentially maps could look like for those of us who shake our fist at what gerrymandering has done to Wisconsin. But the reality is, when it comes to breaking down assembly districts, there's a lot of Republican districts, and even with fair, neutral maps, that could and most likely would still be the case. Right, John?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a succinct way of putting it. If you drew the maps without paying attention to who it benefited politically, and you just followed the rules that our law says you're supposed to when you draw the lines, in a 50-50 year, Republicans would still win a majority.
And it's interesting because I think in one of the articles I read about this that you were quoted in, it was basically in like 100,000 randomly drawn legislative maps, the vast majority of the time, Republicans would get the majority.
Yeah, some, you know, they would get 50 seats or more in a sort of like purely split election year like we so often have in Wisconsin. And that's because of what I call asymmetrical polarization. So, you know, the number of voters in Wisconsin who live in a narrowly contested place has declined. So in 2000, 33% of voters lived, a third of voters lived in a neighborhood that was decided by single digit margin in that presidential election. And that fell to 23% in 2020. The state stayed split, you know,
the state
super narrowly divided between those years. But the number of voters living in one of those narrowly divided neighborhoods fell from a third to less than a quarter. But that didn't happen equally at both ends of the direction. So the number of Republicans living in a dark red neighborhood, a 50-point Republican or more neighborhood, grew from 2% to 5%. And the number of Democrats living in the inverse, a dark blue neighborhood, a 50-point or more blue neighborhood, grew from 9% to 21%. So you saw this
fascinating
concentration of Democrats in these very, very blue neighborhoods. And so when you draw compact contiguous districts, you're going to end up with this set of really, really dark blue seats. And there's not going to be the same thing on the Republican side of the ledger. Now, I have sometimes heard Republican politicians say that this explains their advantage.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that too, usually on Twitter.
Not true. You know, that explains part of their advantage. Maybe about, speaking in rough terms, perhaps half of their majority of seats in the legislature, but not all of them. It's worth pointing out Evers' victory, which was fairly large by Wisconsin standards last November. Under the maps that the People's Map Commission originally submitted, if that map had been chosen, as best I can tell, Evers would have won 53 of those seats. Like, he personally would have won a majority of the votes in 53 of those prospective assembly seats. Now, I don't think Democratic assembly candidates would have won a majority. I think they would have won about seven fewer seats because Republicans have more incumbents. Incumbency advantages was about 4 points based on the research I've done. It's equally benefits Republican incumbents and Democratic incumbents, but we have more Republican incumbents.
Yeah.
So on balance, incumbency advantage helps them.
And so what I always say when I talk about this is, like, it's, I don't really care about a Democratic majority. I care about having more competitive seats because, as we talked earlier in today's show, we have representatives who just don't get back to constituents because they don't have to. And so what, as far as, you know, all these different simulations, beyond who would get the majority, how much do we know about, at least how much more competitive would any of these districts actually end up being?
Right. You know, and as someone who shares the view that democracy works best when politicians of both parties are worried about losing their seats,
yes,
how it is supposed to function. Unfortunately, even if we drew maps, you know, by some definition of fairness, because of this polarization across the state, I don't think there would be this huge group of seats that were actually up for grabs every year.
Huh.
It would increase a lot from what we have now. You know, now it's, in any election, I'm really only paying attention to, at most, I want to say six assembly seats, and really only two or three that I think are, like, really seriously contested. And under neutrally drawn maps, from what I've seen, that might increase, you know, maybe as many as 10, you know, but it wouldn't be a lot more than that, I don't think. Unless you were specifically drawing seats with the intention of drawing as many competitive ones as possible. But that's not what the law calls for.
And that's in the face of actual neutral maps, right? As far as, like, that's still designing maps for a specific outcome.
Exactly. If you're trying to match, you know, communities of interest is the phrase you hear sometimes, you know, towns within big cities, you know, sort of neighborhoods within those, you're actually going to end up following the boundaries of communities of people who mostly agree with each other. A sort of weird, maybe counterintuitive effect of the polarization and gerrymandering we've seen is that I believe more individual citizens in Wisconsin and around the country are represented now by politicians they agree with than back when we had these more contested elections. Because Republicans are in more have Republican-leaning districts, and Democrats are usually in Democratic-leaning districts. So people are more likely to have an individual legislator representing them who they agree with. Kind of strange to wrap your mind.
That is strange to. Well, with a little time that we have left, what would you, for people who are super interested in this, what would you recommend them to continue to watch as this progresses over the next couple months?
Yeah, it's going to be all over the news, I'm sure. You know, any kind of case is going to be in the news. So whatever your preferred news outlet is, they'll be talking about it. I'm sure your show will be too.
We will definitely be talking about it. And then we'll probably have to have you back then to talk more about it.
Yeah, if you know, if any plan actually gets proposed by somebody or the court, I'll certainly run the numbers to see what that might mean going forward.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks for the question.
Absolutely. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University Law School. And we'll be back after the break. Have a great day, John. As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bryce. She is Jane Matinair. Did that burst your bubble at all?
Well, I think a lot more of us are going to have to move.
That's your response?
We're going to have to infiltrate other areas of the state.
Get out of Milwaukee and Madison?
Mine. I'm just move our blue. Expand the blue.
Expand the blue. And I think that's what it comes down to. Is there? And I wanted to ask John this question, and we were starting to run out of time. But as far as when he was saying how places themselves have gotten more polarized,
yeah,
I don't know how that matches up with migration data. Is that because people are moving, or because people's minds are changing? So maybe I'll write him a follow up email and ask, because I think that as he said that, as far as the changes over the last 20 years. Of how many people live in an area where there's some discrepancy between amongst the population as far as how they typically vote versus deep blue, deep red. And as like, is that because people are moving?
Or just changing their minds?
Or just changing their minds. And you know, I think it's, you know, the echo chambers that we get in. And we've talked about this before, and I think it happens on both sides.
Without
as far
a doubt.
As the ability to, like, the people you're surrounded with, everyone kind of, these are the topics that get talked about. These are the issues that get bubble up. And this is, like, becomes kind of your de facto, like, this is how everyone around me thinks. And ultimately, one of the most powerful mechanisms when it comes to human behavior is, like, social pressure of, like, looking at your neighbor and, like, well, what are they doing? And so it'd be fascinating to learn more about that. But I wanted to read a little bit about, because I thought this was fascinating. John wrote a essay from a couple years ago called Why Do Republicans Overperform in Wisconsin State Assembly? Partisan Gerrymandering versus Political Geography. And he says he kind of, because we talk about this, and I think each party has their claim on what is Wisconsin. And so I'm just going to read this, because I think it's a good thing to think about. Wisconsin has a confusing political personality. A casual observer might perceive it as a blue state. After all, 2016 is the only year a Democratic presidential candidate lost the state since 1984. On the other hand, it feels very purple when you consider that Barack Obama is the only presidential candidate since Michael Dukakis to win an outright majority of the vote. In still more ways, you might think of it as a solidly red state. Republicans have controlled the state assembly for all but 3 years of my lifetime. Rather than encouraging a mood of bipartisanship, I think this combination of red and blue traits leads many Republicans and Democrats alike to believe they are the, quote, true representatives of Wisconsin who are only stymied by the illegitimate interference of the other party. My preferred description is that Wisconsin, politically speaking, is not one moderate state. Rather, it is one very conservative state overlapping another very liberal one. And I think that's true. Like, I think depending on what parts of the state you're in.
Oh, yeah.
How liberal and how conservative you get.
But I still think, too, that we agree on more things than we realize. And it's our politicians that want to keep us divided. Don't we all want clean, poison-free water?
Yes.
Don't we all want decent childcare for our kids? Don't we all want education for our children? I just think there are more things that we agree on than disagree. And the one thing about if we would get fair maps, and I understand Democrats would still be at a disadvantage, but that's fine with me. I don't like cheaters, and I don't think Wisconsin likes cheaters or respects people who cheat. And having fairer maps would hold some of these people accountable who have been in office for decades and now don't even respond to their constituents' phone calls.
The Mark Lane thing is so infuriating.
Why are we okay with that? Why are we okay with these guys in their cushy jobs, in their cushy offices, with their per diems? And
well, and I think that's the thing that I think about then is, you know, I do think no matter what, regardless of who gets the majority, neutral maps are a good thing.
Yes.
And this is what we should be working towards. And then for me, I still, and this may be pie in the sky, but it still comes back to, I think, final five voting or ranked choice voting or getting rid of the partisan primaries where the people that end up in the general are so far apart from one another because the people who voted them to get into the general were in the primary, and that's like 20% of the base.
Yeah.
And so the people that they vote for is not representative of the like general electorate. And so we get these like very skewed like candidates instead of people who want to compromise. And so maybe that's the next big thing. Once we can get fair maps is maybe to start.
That's going to be a long stretch.
That's a long stretch. The only legislation, like bill that's been proposed so far, and it is a bipartisan bill for final five voting, is that's not even for state elections. It's for federal elections.
Oh.
And so that would be Senate in Congress, and which would be something for especially for Congress. But I would love to see it at the Assembly and State Senate level as well.
Again, that's going to be a long, drawn out fight.
Yeah.
Gosh, we can't even agree on mail in ballots. It's crazy.
Well, I think I just lost track of time because I thought this was our 8-minute segment.
No.
So I didn't even. We're going to save that question then.
Okay.
Instead. But it's Juneteenth. And so, Jane, how familiar are you with Juneteenth and why we celebrate it?
From what I understand, this is the date when somebody announced to Texas, Texans were the last ones to know, that the slaves had been freed.
Yeah.
Right?
Basically. Pretty much. Yeah. So pretty much, you know, in the comparison to, if you don't read news for a day, you're behind. Sometimes it feels like where we're at today. But if you imagine back in the 1800s, specifically.
News did not necessarily travel fast.
1865. Mm. It took 899 days. So nearly 2.5 years for word of President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, the executive order that legally freed 3.5 million people to reach the country's last enslaved people in Texas. So 2.5 more years, I'm sure that was the last spot, but I'm sure there was other places along the way. Like, it wasn't just like light switch.
Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. You are free. Here is your, is it 4 acres and a mule? 2 acres and a mule, you know, and like go forth. It was a wave of how the information trickled out, because I'm sure there were some people who were not necessarily fast to spread that information.
Let's keep that to ourselves for a year or two.
Which is wild to think about. And so that's why this celebration of freedom is known as Juneteenth, as it earned its rightful place on the national calendar of holidays. And it is a federal holiday now. And Wisconsin actually plays a small role in the holiday's history. So our state was the first in the North to celebrate Juneteenth with a parade and a festival, which is the one that's happening today in Milwaukee. So in 1971 was Milwaukee's first Juneteenth parade and festival, and that is apparently one of the oldest out of the northern states to celebrate. And then Governor Tony Evers proclaimed in 2020 that the Juneteenth flag would fly for the entire day over the state capitol. So that is hanging high today. And so I just thought, you know, I think this is something that has been celebrated in the Black community for a very long time and is only, I mean, certainly being recognized as a federal holiday is very new. It's also going through a weird, like anything, the ability, like when we talk about Pride is having a backlash this year, but like the corporation, like corporatization, that's not the word that I want to use, of Pride, of profiting off of it and, you know, capitalism in general with everything that's happened with Pride over the last decade or so. Certainly there's like parts of it that feel very cringy that are happening with Juneteenth, in that like Chuck Schumer was wearing like a Juneteenth like t-shirt and supposedly the CEO of the company that tried to or did trademark Juneteenth is white. And so there's like there's some really cringy stuff that's happening about with the mainstreaming of Juneteenth,
the commercialization of.
Yes.
But we do that with everything.
We do it with everything. And so regardless of that, though, I think it's still a fairly new, like not everyone necessarily knows why it's celebrated.
Sure.
Or that hit piece of history of how long it took for all of the enslaved people to realize that they were now free. So I just thought I would add that piece of history
844
as we celebrate today.
967-2789, 844-96-PARTY. Going back to John Johnson, who had just joined us to talk about gerrymandering. Jesse from Madison wants to chime in. Hey, Jesse, what do you think?
Hey, folks. I heard your previous guest suggest that having more voters represented by someone that actually agrees with them was kind of an accidental or maybe unintended consequence of gerrymandering. I've really thought for a while now that that was actually the intention, because if your representative of either persuasion agrees with you, you're less like, why would you write them a letter? Why would you call them at all? All of a sudden, that's a waste of your time. If they're on the fence in a competitive district, then it makes sense to do that. And when you reduce that reaching out, you reduce all kinds of things. You reduce fundraising, you reduce volunteering, you reduce voting, and it's a voter suppression technique.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I was going to say is that as far as Juneteenth goes, the way I learned it was that the slaves already knew about the decree that they were freed, and so did the slave, quote-unquote, owners at the time, but that was the day that Union troops actually went to Galveston to actually enforce it.
Oh, interesting. So it wasn't that news was spreading, it was that it was finally being enforced.
Right.
Oh.
That's the way I learned it, at least. I could be wrong, but that's the way I was.
Here's a question, Jesse. When did you first learn about Juneteenth? Because I always think this is interesting as far as like the history of...
After college.
Yeah, so this was not something we learned in high school or college.
No.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think I learned about it until the last 5 years.
If I did, it was a footnote.
Yeah, didn't stand out.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Jesse. Really appreciate it. You can always check in anytime, call and or text at 844-967-2789. That's 844-96-PARTY.
I did get, going back to the top of the hour, and I need to go research this more before we dive into it, but I do think there's probably something to be compare and contrast to, because as we talked about with the Republican convention that was this past weekend and my frustrations with what they were highlighting as resolutions as far as their stake in the sand of
what's really important,
where the delegates stand on certain issues.
Yeah.
I guess one of the ones for Democrats the week prior was legalizing psychedelics.
Okay.
Criminal charges for child labor violations, but I need to go through and see if there were some kind of like kooky ones from the Democrats too, because, you know.
Well, they want to slip in what they can slip in, right?
And again, like I think there's an argument for psychedelics and
to be studied, yes.
And things that are happening as far as depression and anxiety and stuff like that. Is that the most important thing to be talking about at the convention? I would say no. I would say there are other things that we should be focused on right now, but
like childcare.
Yeah, you know, but it's like I don't know enough about what happens at these conventions since I've never been a delegate of any flavor whatsoever. So maybe I'm Maybe I'm missing the point of these resolutions, and someone can educate me on why they're important.
Big wish list party.
All right. Well, when we come back, Robin Grams is going to be here, who is the associate planner for the city of Waukesha, and he's here to talk about Riverside Rhythms, which is taking place every Wednesday this summer from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the city of Waukesha. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I'm Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And starting now already, Riverside Rhythms, which takes place every Wednesday this summer from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the city of Waukesha, is happening. And here to talk more about it is Robin Grams, who is the associate planner for the city of Waukesha. How you doing, Robin?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Make sure you're right up on that mic.
Great. Thanks for having me
there
on.
There you go.
Awesome. That's perfect.
I think if we were here last year, because how long has Riverside Rhythms been happening?
This is the fourth year.
Okay.
We didn't during COVID, but since then we've been going strong, and each year it's been growing. Last week was the first one, and there were about over 100 people there. Great turnout. It's really gaining interest. And I mean, this year we have great sponsors. We keep getting more each year. We have Eaton, Generac, Metal Tech, and Orange Hat Publishing. So some of the big organizations in Waukesha. So
nice. So I guess we didn't really explain what it is. What is it?
So it is a lunchtime concert series. We have live local musicians. So in the past, sometimes we had a couple each year, but this year we had over 30 applications for 11 dates.
Wow.
Yes. So it's gaining a lot of interest, and I had to go through and listen to...
I was going to say, how do you pick? Do you get to choose personally?
I do.
You're like, it's the music you like?
Yes and no. I try to get a variety. So
okay.
we have a good mix. Some of the ones we've had in the past, we know they have a good following and people enjoy their music. But we added a few new ones this year, including Robert Allen Jr. Band, who's played at Summerfest and the State Fair, and Kenneth Yerkes, who did some performing at Chef Pam's Kitchen during the Walktober Beer and Wine Walk. So
oh, sure.
We've added a few new ones. So yeah, but I get to pick the food trucks too, which
Ooh.
Is great. Yeah.
Did you get to taste all the food trucks, or is that more of a blind a blind choice?
We volunteer to help you with that next year, Bob.
Yeah, definitely do that next year. We have some new ones this year that were added, but in the past we've had Mammy Felice. They're coming back again. Great Tamales and Tacos. Mama D's, which is a downtown business. We try to incorporate as many downtown businesses as possible. So the event actually takes place on Riverfront Street, which is right behind the Civic Theater by the Salty Toad in that area. So we try to get people to come to the downtown. So like I said, live local musicians and local food trucks as well. So new this year is the Phoenix Mobile Grill and Rose Mob Grill, but we also have Crazy Taco, Mr. P's Grilled Cheese, Timber Barbecue, so we have a good selection.
So then each Wednesday, is it one food truck, or is there multiple options you can choose from once you show up for the concert?
One food truck. So
okay.
We don't charge a fee to have the food trucks there. Whatever money comes in is theirs to keep. So we try to just keep it as one so that people can have a choice, but we change it each week.
Got it.
And It's been great. It's like I said, last week was a great turnout. Looking forward to the next few weeks. The only date that it's not going to happen is July 5th, just due to the holiday that Wednesday.
Robin, what about seating and stuff? Do I need to bring my own foldy chair in, or a blanket or something?
So great question. We recommend people bring their chairs. We do have some available. The Waukesha Civic Theater was kind enough to donate their chairs each Wednesday. So we wheel them out and we set up chairs. I'd say about 20, 30 chairs, but with the amount of people that come, I would definitely recommend, if you can, bring a folding chair.
And then, so where is it exactly? So it's right by the theater?
Right behind the theater is so the theater fronts on Main Street,
mm-hmm.
and then right behind is Riverfront Street. So Riverfront Street was in the plans for a long time to we wanted our goals to activate that area. It used to be where the old farmers market was,
okay.
and it was built and designed to be able to hold events. So what we did, it's under the old bus depot, so people have some shade to sit under, and then we set up a tent for the musician as well. So, and then the food truck, we reserve a couple spots right by where the people are sitting, and people can walk right up and
that's so fun. So then for this area, like what would you say, not that you probably know the exact number, but like how many people are driving from their work spot to come see it versus walking from this area to be able to be there?
So in the past, it was outside Barso Plaza, so we know people from the state building would kind of walk over. Now that it's Riverfront Street, I know there's people, including some my family members that drive and some people in the area, but it's a lot of people walk from the Riverfront apartments, and some of the local businesses come out and walk, and it's just... We'd still get some of the state employees, some of the city hall employees there as well. But yeah, it's been great.
That's one of the great things about downtown Waukesha, though. It really is very walkable.
Mm-hmm.
It is. And there's just so many great little gems, little restaurants, coffee shops, little shop-hays.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful.
Well, and I also appreciate, as someone who was not always very good at taking a lunch break I was like, I'm just going to work through lunch, blah, blah, blah. Like, to hear that people are like, no, I'm going to take an actual break.
And go to lunch.
And go listen to music and actually eat lunch and support a local business. Like, that's great to hear. So with the couple minutes that we have left, reminder of where it is, when it is, and where people can get more information, Robin.
So, again, it's every Wednesday this summer, besides July 5th, from 11:30 to 1 p.m., it is located under the old bus depot on Riverfront Street. The address is 29 Riverfront Street by Riverfront Plaza. You can, if you are looking for information, not just for this event, for Walktober, and then also like Friday Night Live, the Farmers Market,
mm-hmm.
we have a downtown Waukesha page. So we update the event calendars. If people are playing music down at some of the local bars and other things, we add those to the schedule. So there's great lists. I know we have Tribute Tuesday, Movies in the Park. There's a lot of stuff going on. So Waukesha, Downtown Waukesha website.
Downtown Waukesha website.
I'm telling you, go to the Waukesha Farmers Market. There is a woman selling maple and bacon scones that will change the course of your life.
Yeah, they're having a great turnout this year. It's been great.
So. Jade was there 2 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago, yeah.
When are you going to be there next?
Next month.
All right. Maybe I'll join you.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, Robin, thank you so much for stopping in. It's always fun to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, well, that will do it for us today. Thank you for texting. Thank you for calling. Thank you for being part of the show. We will be back again tomorrow at 10 a.m. to do it all over again. This has been As Goes Wisconsin.